This is my depiction of a gene. Okay, that's what a genetic chromosome looks like for any of you who've been in school. It does not look like this. So there isn't a gene for anorexia nervosa. That's absurd. Okay, these illnesses are all multigenic. There are many genetic influences that play a role in predisposing somebody to develop an eating disorder. So that's not the way one should look at it. This is much more the story. So here you have all of the 46 human chromosomes, and there are probably influences that determine how easy is it for someone to vomit. It's an interesting phenomenon. Vomiting appears highly genetic. Some people can easily vomit and others can't. Patients will tell me, you know, my mother vomits all the time. She just leans over a toilet bowl and it's easy for me to vomit. Other patients will say, I can't vomit no matter what I do. That there's probably a genetic aspect to the control of the gag reflex that makes it easier for some people and harder for others. That actually increases the risk for an eating disorder if it's easy to vomit. Anxiety plays a role. Obsessionality plays a role. So these are temperament. Temperament is a powerful genetic factor. It is the most powerful factor in the genetic studies we have done, is temperament. Harm avoidance, obsessionality, perfectionism, temperament is the biologic aspects of personality. These are the factors that are coming out more than any other in determining the genetic predisposition. So you don't develop a gene for anorexia nervosa. You inherit a gene that determines your temperament. And that temperament makes you more likely to develop an eating disorder. It's important to understand that. And then there are protective factors. Or self-esteem may be there. Constitutional thinness, there are some people who are just naturally very thin. It would be harder for them to get an eating disorder. Not impossible, but harder. Mentioned the others here. But then there's the protective factors, so nurturing and bonding and all that. So we've talked about gender. The other aspect in terms of genetics, which is the gender piece, why do eating disorders occur more in women? That question plagued researchers up until about 5 years ago. We did not have a good answer for that. And it's not just because, I mean, you don't get anorexia nervosa by reading Glamour magazine. It just doesn't happen, okay? Everybody reads Glamour magazine. Why are women more likely to get it? The answer is that the brains of women are very different than the brains of men. This is work of Paul Cowan and his group in London, England. He did some elegant experiments. He actually wasn't looking specifically at eating disorders. He was looking at depression. And what he did is he took a group of 100 men and 100 women, healthy people, no psychiatric problems, and he put them on for 72 hours a diet depleted of tryptophan. What is tryptophan? Tryptophan is an essential amino acid that is converted in your brain to serotonin. And what is serotonin? Serotonin is a very important neuromodulator in our brains of satiety, mood, impulsivity. It's critical. And we know that in depression and in eating disorders, serotonin is low. Within 72 hours of putting these people on low serotonin, he then did an LP, that's a lumbar puncture, and he measured the fluid in the spine that comes from the brain. It's an indirect measure of brain activity. And he looked for what the level of serotonin was in the men and the women. And what he found was remarkable. In men, there was no change in the level of serotonin. It was normal. And very few of the men complained of getting depressed. In the women, he couldn't measure serotonin in the CSF. It was so low, it was unmeasurable. 3 days of tryptophan depletion, and many of these women started complaining of dysphoric mood. What does this tell us? It tells us that the brains of women are much more susceptible to dietary manipulation than the brains of men. Why is that? Every woman in this room knows the answer to that. Estrogen and progesterone have a huge role to play in modulating serotonin and hunger and satiety. Women's eating changes through the menses and certainly during pregnancy. Men do not have any circulating estrogen and progesterone. They don't go through those changes. Okay, so women's brains are so highly different than men's. And it's obviously the case that women are the gender more likely to go on diets. What are diets? Diets, the average diet, which is low in fat, low in carbs, high in protein, is tryptophan deficient. So what are people doing when they're dieting? They're depleting their brain of serotonin. Now, if you have good genes and your serotonin system can pick that up and kick in and produce more serotonin to compensate, you'll be all right. If you have inherited a risk for, let's say, depression or eating disorders, your brain is not going to be able to respond as quickly, and you will put yourself at risk for binge eating or mood shifts. And that's important. Okay, so what's my take-home message? Not only is dieting useless, because it doesn't work, okay, we all know that, dieting lowers your metabolism, and you, when you start eating again, which you eventually will, you will gain weight more rapidly, but it actually is harmful. Okay, it really does change your brain chemistry. And so, you know, it's a kind of advocate for the dieting industry is a $3 billion industry, which is all based on false advertising. It's amazing to me that this goes on. There are no lawsuits, by the way, in the United States against certain dieting ads and dieting companies because of this. If you really do want to try to change your weight, the way to do that is not on the input side, it's on the output side. So exercise increases metabolism, and you're much more likely to be able to lose some weight and maintain it. Maintenance is the key. Any diet will lead to weight loss in the short term, but it's not sustainable. And that is now true of all of these newer fad diets, the low-carb, South Beach, Atkins. The studies are now out. In the first 6 months, there's tremendous weight loss. 2 or 3 years later, where are those people? They either couldn't tolerate the diet and went off it, or they've gained the weight back. There are very few people who can keep their weight off. And if they do that, it's primarily because they've also increased their activity. And that's the key. Other psychiatric disorders. Eating disorders come in families that have other psychiatric illnesses. There are three other specific psychiatric disorders that run in the families of people with eating disorders. Mood disorders, primarily in the women, substance use, primarily in the men, and anxiety disorders in both sexes. Okay? You do not see an increase in schizophrenia and eating disorders at all. So there's a spectrum of psychiatric illness in the families of people with anorexia and bulimia, and they are in the area of disturbed mood, substance use, and one of the theories is that whatever is genetic, in men, it comes out in the form of alcohol, because maybe it's more socially acceptable for men to drink, and in women, it comes out in the form of binge eating, because it may not be as acceptable for women to drink. But the same genetic vulnerability is there. The genotype's the same. The phenotype, the form of the illness, is different. Okay, so that's one way to conceptualize it. Weight. Weight is highly genetically determined, and I said that before. So these are the twin studies that have been done in a number of studies. This paper was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is the standard for the world, and it shows that the cause of or variants attributable to genes and obesity is 85%. So 15% of your weight is related to what you do in your life, i.e. how you eat and whether you exercise. 85% is determined by the genes you got from your parents. And it's not that, this is a no-brainer, guys, right? I mean, thin people come from thin families. Tall people come from families where there's lots of tall people. Short people come from families where there's lots of short people. It's the same thing with weight, okay? That doesn't mean you can't change your weight. I've already said that. But the influence of genes, and it's way more genetic than schizophrenia, hypertension, alcoholism, epilepsy, or coronary artery disease. Okay, so let's go back and talk about the psychological risks. We know that there are certain psychological disturbances that occur in children. You can even see it in children who go on to develop eating disorders. What are they? They have problems with their identity. I think somebody mentioned this last night. As you grow older, you start to form a core identity. Something goes wrong in the development of people who go on to develop an eating disorder. It's very complex, and I don't have time to get into what it is that actually happens. But there is an absence of a core identity in a young child as she goes on to adolescence, and it's in adolescence that identity is solidified, that puts that kid at risk. Okay, self-esteem. So self-esteem should be unconditional. As parents, we should love our kids, and there's absolutely nothing that they have to do. That is the ideal healthy scenario. That isn't always the case in families. In families where self-esteem is tied to achievement and appearance, there are potential problems that could occur. Autonomy. So the goal of, you know, being a parent is an odd business, right? Because you know you've been a success when your kid doesn't need you anymore. It's a very odd business. I'm at that stage now, okay, so I know how it feels. Kids are independent, so you must have done a great job. It doesn't feel very good for me as a parent because I like them. But they don't need you anymore. So something goes off in the development of a child, and it does have something to do with the parent-child interaction, usually the mother. If you have a depressed mother, and if that mother makes the child feel that she has to be there to take care of the mother, the child becomes parentified. That interferes with age-appropriate separation. And you see that even as early as starting school. There's higher rates of school phobia in kids that go on to develop anorexia nervosa. That's an interesting study that found that. They tend to be anxious kids. And when they hit adolescence, what's the task of adolescence? Negotiate a separate sense of identity, autonomy, healthy sexuality. These kids can't cope. They feel guilty for separating. And that sets them up. And sexuality. So unfortunately, there are significant rates of sexual molestation, abuse, and rape in patients who go on to develop eating disorders. It's not specific to eating disorders, by the way. It's about 35%. It's not the majority, but it's significant. And it's a risk factor for psychiatric illness. 35% of alcoholic women have been sexually abused. 35% of depressed women have been sexually abused. What seems more specific in eating disorders is intrafamilial abuse, incest. Okay, so that, for whatever reason, which is not that clear, that seems to be a more specific risk that the form of the disturbance will go down the path of an eating disorder than it would go down the path of, let's say, drugs or alcohol. So let's talk briefly about family, vocation, media. And this is where I'm going to say a lot more about this in the section about the religious or Jewish community. A family can either magnify or buffer the societal pressure on young women. And we live in a very nasty society in terms of what it does to our kids. All you have to do is watch some TV or look at some magazines. And a family, parents can either tie acceptance and self-esteem to weight and shape or achievement, or provide a safe environment of unconditional acceptance for a child that is not tied to achievement or appearance. I would obviously advocate for the latter. There are also vocational things that you should avoid as a parent. So when my daughter at age 5 said, "I'd like to dance," I took her to a ballet class at some place, I don't remember where, and I took her to a modern jazz class at the Y, the North Y. I think it was the South Y, actually. And the experience was completely different. The ballet class, there were only young girls. The teacher was mean. Nobody was happy. And the walls were covered in mirrors. Everybody looked like they were having a very miserable time. The modern class had boys and girls. The teacher was laughing and joking. The kids were having a great time. There wasn't a mirror to be seen. Okay, so which class are you going to put your daughter in? Do you want to focus her at age 5 or 6 or 7 unduly on weight and shape? I don't think so. I don't think that's a very good idea. Because she's already struggling with the larger society that does that. Same thing with competitive athletics or modeling. Okay, so I see this all the time in my practice, where parents unknowingly are really harming their kids by emphasizing and even forcing them into these kinds of activities. And the media. The media is a huge problem. I'm going to go through this quickly. So our media says you can never be too rich or too thin, our society. This is the Chinese practice of foot binding, which if you know anything about Chinese attitudes towards women, this was considered to be a beautiful thing, to bind your feet. Look what it does to the foot bones. Right, so just because a society deems something to be desirable does not make it healthy. Smoking in our society is a great example of that. When I was growing up, it was cool to smoke. If you look at old movies, everybody's smoking. Movies in the 60s and 70s. We know now it's the most unhealthy practice. Wearing a corset. Some women may have read about this. I don't think anyone's old enough to have actually gone through this period. But it actually caused pulmonary failure. It reduced pulmonary capacity to the point that women couldn't breathe and went into pulmonary failure. And even though the society said that really makes women look nice. Again, we're bombarded with movie stars with eating disorders. It gets romanticized and idealized. It's a huge problem. This is somebody who is, I don't know, Clifford Flockhart, I think. Starving for success. Again, you just have to stand in line at Dominion and you can pick out these pictures. These are some of my favorite things. It's amazing to me that intelligent people believe this. So you put on this rubber suit, the Space Age Slenderizer, and you wear it overnight and you'll lose weight. And people actually buy this and do it. I mean, these are ads for Saturday Night Live. Now we're into feeding your pet less. Okay, mind-boggling. And we now make moralistic judgments about food. There's good food and there's bad food. If you eat good food, you're good. If you eat bad food, you're a bad person. How absurd. How absurd is that? Don't step on it. It makes you cry. This is the message I want to give people. I've tried a lot of diets. My body keeps rejecting them. And we should all support the Body Shop. There are 3 billion women who don't look like supermodels, only 8 who do. The Body Shop has a particular campaign against this kind of pressure on women. And do we ever want to go here? We're getting close to this. Okay? It is absurd. So our society adds to the problem and doesn't make it better. So what's the high-risk profile? Somebody asked last night, what's the warning signs in our kids? This is a caricature, but if you have a kid, you know a kid like this, you better be worried. Okay? So this is a 10-year-old girl. She's got a family history of an eating disorder, depression, alcoholism, and obesity. She's considered chubby. Her parents are overly in weight and shape preoccupied. Her mother's chronically depressed, parentifies her. She's in a competitive ballet class, and she was molested by the neighbor's son at age 8 when he was babysitting her. That girl has a huge risk to develop an eating disorder when she hits adolescence. Right now, you wouldn't be able to tell there's anything wrong with her. So those are the risk factors. They're in place already, and she hits adolescence. So how do we tease out the genetic and environmental factors? Let me just go. So here's an example. Here's an environment I was just talking about. That's a ballet class, right? What's wrong with that? Well, this is somebody who has a genotype, let's call it AABB. Right? That person enters the ballet class. Here's another person with a different genotype, little a, little b. What happens to those two people? This person becomes Karen Kane, a prima ballerina. And the other one develops severe anorexia nervosa. Okay? What's the take-home message? Genes load the gun, and the environment pulls the trigger. Okay, so if you know you have a loaded gun, you better pay attention to your environment more than if you didn't. That's really the take-home message, and that's the interplay between genes and environment. So let's talk about the specific issues in the Jewish and even more specifically Orthodox communities. So there are possible protective factors. There's some possible risk factors. There's some special treatment considerations and directions for future research. I'll preface my remarks by saying there are no published studies that support evidence that the eating disorders are higher in the Jewish community. Having said that, there's anecdotal evidence of that from a number of different centers. Now, again, you have to be very careful about this, right? So what was it that Hamas said? If I can mention that name here. Why they were going to introduce Sharia law. They said because in Sweden, they were going to introduce segregated classes. Because in Sweden, they have high suicide rates and the classes are integrated. So that was their rationale. So we don't want to have high suicide rates, so we're going to separate boys and girls. That's a perfect example of attributing causality to a phenomena that has nothing to do with, they just happen to occur together, right? The fact that kids are in school together, I think, has absolutely nothing to do with suicide rates. So it's risky to say just because I or somebody else sees a lot of Orthodox or Jewish patients, and it seems out of proportion to the population, that there's a higher prevalence of it. But the truth is, we do. We see lots of Orthodox patients in our program, and when I compare notes to people across the world in areas that have obviously large Jewish populations, that is what people report. Hadassah Reyes, who's sitting back here and works with us, did a survey a number of years ago where she interviewed people in the Orthodox community. You might want to comment at the end. And some of what I'm going to say is taken from her work because there isn't much else out there published. Right? So basically, why might it be protective to be, let's say, religious or Orthodox? Because Torah beliefs really do fly in the face of the larger society values. And these counterbalance those of our larger society. Torah believes in internal beauty and spirituality, and really not in external things. There is less exposure to the noxious influence of the media, which is a good thing. I mean, there's something to be said about all of us throwing our TVs out. I do have to say that. What you see on TV mostly is horrendous. There are the laws of modesty. Okay, it's tzniyistic. So there's something about laws of modesty that de-emphasize the body and sexuality, which may not be such a bad thing for young women. Food and eating are considered a mitzvah in Torah and in certain occasions, and also tied in with spiritual experience. It's not just a hedonistic experience. And there is, it is a very large, supportive community with family and friends. Many girls attend an all-girls high school. My daughter, in grade 9, went to chat and came home and said, I don't want to deal with boys. The boys are bothering me. I don't want in grade 9, when I'm 14 years old, to have grade 12 boys asking me out on dates. That's not who I am. She's much happier in Opana. I can tell you that. For her, that worked. Okay, I'm not saying it's for every kid, but there's probably some protection that girls experience when they're not exposed to the pressure daily of, you know, an adolescent environment that includes young men. What are some of the risk factors? Well, there is an unhealthy emphasis in response to the question yesterday on thinness that does result from the whole pressure of shidduchim. I've seen this many times. I've seen potential matches broken up because the young woman is not fat, but not thin. I mean, we're not talking about even being obese. We're just talking about not being thin, or that the young woman, the young man's family meets the parents and the mother is overweight. I've seen matches end on that basis. To me, this is a chilul Hashem. It's a complete distortion of the values of Torah and Judaism, that we would base the choice of our children's mates on such ridiculous, superficial things. And that's something we all have to work on. Food and eating is an important aspect of the Sabbath and holidays, but again, there's a lot of it. Okay? And my religious patients struggle with this, that they're expected, when Yontif falls on Thursday and Friday, and then there's Shabbat, it's the worst nightmare for my religious patients. And they do everything they can to avoid ending up at the table with their families, because there is so much eating. Again, what may be a positive thing and protective may also be a negative thing. Girls can be very catty. There's a lot of competition amongst girls for weight and shape and appearance. And that may also be a problem in an all-girls school. The double curriculum is a high-pressure situation, if you take it seriously. And, you know, girls who do find themselves under tremendous pressure for achievement, not just in secular studies, but in Limudei Kodesh as well. And this is the number one issue in my experience. If I had to say what is the number one issue for this conference, it is the stigma that the religious community puts on mental illness and especially on eating disorders. I do not understand this. If you ask a from group of people what is the worst thing that their daughter could develop, it's an eating disorder. It's not schizophrenia. It's anorexia or bulimia. That seems to take them off of any list for a shidduch. And I don't quite understand it. Our field in general stigmatizes eating disorders more than any other mental illness, but in particular in the religious community. It is a huge problem. And, you know, I think people spoke to this last night about the pressure that the professionals are under. And in my own experience, this has been a huge issue in terms of trying to treat people from the Orthodox community and the incredible shame and stigma that families and Rebbeim put on this. And again, it's largely out of ignorance, in my opinion. Largely out of ignorance. So we have a job to educate people. What kind of treatments? We need to get into the schools, and that's not easy. Try to get into Beis Yaakov to do a prevention program. Okay, good luck. We've tried, and it's not easy. Okay, community-based programs, I think, are helpful, where people come, JCC, the synagogue, educational awareness programs for rabbis, to educate rabbis and spiritual leaders so they understand these things better, training for Orthodox therapists and counseling for families. Treatment programs should occur in a warm, non-threatening environment and, again, free of pressure. And you could argue, so there is, I'm not sure even people know this, I'm not sure I should say it, but there is a group home for women who are being sexually abused by their partners in this community. But it's under, the CIA could not find out where this place is. Now again, I think there's a good reason to keep it secret, to protect the people who have to go there. But a lot of it is also the stigma and the shanda and the kherpa associated with the fact that the Orthodox community has to have a place where women who are being sexually battered by their husbands have to go in order to get away and not be beaten to death. Right? So there is a place like that in this city, and it's reality. So again, I always feel we need to face reality rather than deny it. I think people who treat, they don't have to be Orthodox, but they need to be aware of the specific issues in Orthodox patients that are unique, related to the life cycle, Shabbat, holidays, kashrut. Again, some of my patients know I'm traditional, some of them don't. This young girl who had such a degree of loss of control that she had to eat mamish treif during a binge. I can't tell you the angst and pain that that caused her and led to a number of suicidal attempts, right? So somebody, a therapist has to appreciate what it means for an Orthodox girl to eat a cheeseburger at McDonald's and the ramifications of that, not just for her family, but intrapsychically, the guilt and unbelievable sense of being sinful that that caused. We need to ensure confidentiality and safety, and that the environment should really be safe. So one could argue that if we don't have a residential center in Greater Toronto for Orthodox kids, this is a problem, because it's more difficult treating Orthodox kids in hospital environments. It's harder to keep confidentiality. The food, you can get kosher food, but it's more difficult. It's more difficult to refeed people using TV meals or airline meals. So we need to work harder to improve the situation. I think schools have a huge role to play, and this remains, in my opinion, an obstacle. The Orthodox school system does not freely allow access to kids who are in trouble, to professionals. And programs should focus on prevention, on improving body image rather than eating behavior. So future research, we need to continue to inquire into the needs for services to address eating disorders and whether services should be provided internally or externally. Focus groups with Orthodox kids, I think, is a good idea to find out what they need and whether there are specific risk factors. We don't know scientifically and clearly whether that is in fact the case. So there's a need for treatment services to address eating disorders. Programs should ensure confidentiality. Programs should work to decrease stigma, I highlight that, and shame. And programs should focus on increasing awareness, knowledge, and understanding. Thank you very much.
I want to thank you, Alan. I thought that was just fantastic. I really did. And I'm saying that even as one who does not read Glamour magazine. it was a long session, and we do have a schedule, so we're just going to allow, I would say, about 10 minutes for questions, and if you want to speak to Alan privately, you can. So,
What do we know about eating disorders in Orthodox, fundamentalist, other religions?
It's an interesting question. I've myself treated a number of very religious Muslims. The issues are more similar than different because the psychology is the same, right? The form of one's practice, religious practice, is different, but the underlying disturbance in psychology is the same. I had a very unique experience, probably the most amazing experience of my professional career. I was asked by the British Columbia government to be an expert consultant and go into the Montrose Center. I don't know if people remember the Montrose Center. It was a private place in Victoria, B.C., run by somebody, in my opinion, who was not qualified. And it got into all kinds of trouble. So they asked me to go in there. I spent a week there. And it was the United Nations of eating disorders. None of the people, these were young girls, were from Canada. There were kids from Japan, the royal family of the Saudis, the royal family of the Great Britain, the United States, Africa. These were, you know, for the most part, children who came from very wealthy families, but from all across the world with different cultures. I went in from one room to the next, and it felt like I was in a world's fair because the, you know, accoutrements were all different. The illness was exactly the same. It was mind-boggling to me. The kids said the same thing to me in a different language, and I had to have a translator for some of these kids. The Chinese girl and the Japanese girl with anorexia, it was the same psychopathology as the girl from Birmingham, Alabama, whose mother ran the Miss America pageant, or, you know, whatever. There wasn't that much different. So I don't think the illness changes that much. There are cultural differences in how body image is expressed, but the approach and the disturbance is remarkably robust. I mean, more than any other psychiatric illness, there's a homogeneity about anorexia nervosa. If you took a group of 100 anorexics who were underweight, you would find an incredible amount of similarity between them. So I don't know if that answers your question. I don't know about prevalence. I couldn't answer that question. There are studies in Israel, interestingly, published studies of prevalence of eating disorders in the Russian community in Israel, in the Hasidic community, in the Sephardic community. As you get more acculturated to Western style, the rates go up. But it's, again, primarily bulimia that seems to be that, not anorexia.
I'm having trouble with the chart that you showed that said that it was 0% for family influence. It just doesn't make any sense to me that it could be zero.
Yeah, I always hesitate to show those Venn diagrams, because those pie diagrams, because the zero is a statistical zero. It's not an absolute zero. So I don't know what profession you're in, and I'm not a statistician. But we're talking about statistical significance. So you can have events that occur but do not reach a level of probability. And so from a probability standpoint, the role that families play in causing eating disorders is not statistically significant. Okay, but it's there. So I don't know if I can explain it any other way. But it wouldn't be the primary cause of an eating disorder. That's the take-home message. Don't get stuck on the figure. I think the important message I'm trying to give you is, let's not blame families anymore. That's really the message. There's a highly genetic illness that has certain other features associated with it that lead to its,
If you have a family that covers up the illness or denies the illness, isn't that
That doesn't cause the illness. We're not talking about what keeps it going. Two separate issues, so that's a good point. I'm talking about etiology, not what keeps this illness going. Families have a huge role to play in how they deal with it. Once your daughter gets ill, how you deal with it is going to determine the course of that illness. And you're absolutely right. If a family denies it or covers it up, that's going to perpetuate it and make it worse. But I'm talking about root cause, not what perpetuates it. Okay, so what causes someone to take cocaine may be genetic. What keeps them taking cocaine is the withdrawal effects of cocaine. Two different things.
Two questions. One, I'm just wondering about the psychological risk factors. You mentioned that for some reason, if the sexual abuse is intrafamilial, there's more of a risk. And I'm wondering if you think there's a relationship between that and the autonomy risk factor. Because specifically, if you're talking intrafamilial, you're talking about the need to separate perhaps would be that much higher, right? Okay, that's one. And the other is you were speaking about the lack, I think, you said, of studies specifically within the Orthodox community to get a sense of the rates in comparison to the general population. Are you aware of Ira Sacker's study, and what do you know about it? I remember reading this years ago. It was 1 out of 19 girls in the Orthodox Jewish community. And this was done on Hasidic and modern Orthodox and also the Syrian community in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I am aware of that. When you look at science, one has to look at the methodology of studies. In other words, to say that a drug works doesn't mean it works. You have to compare it to a placebo in a rigorous way. So there aren't rigorous studies that I'm aware of. You can do a survey of a school system in a Jewish area and get rates. Okay, but the important thing is, how do those rates compare to the rates in another school system as a control? Right. So again, I don't like making broad statements unless there's clear evidence to support it. There's certainly evidence pointing that way. But I'm not yet comfortable getting up in front of an audience like this and saying that the rates of eating disorders are definitely higher in the Jewish or Orthodox community. In answer to your first question, I think it's an important question. It does get into some of the sophisticated area of development. But suffice it to say that there couldn't be a more severe breach of trust in a young girl than have her father sexually abuse her. And in anorexia nervosa and bulimia, there is a huge issue with trust. That it's a fundamental, primitive absence or lack of trust, not only in themselves, but in the world. And so that's part of why I think it leads more down the path of needing to control my body. because I cannot trust anybody in this world with it. The body becomes something hateful because a young girl has only one explanation for that experience, and that's that I did something to cause it. There's no other way cognitively that an 8-year-old girl can explain why her father or brother did that other than it's my fault and there's something about my body that's damaged and deficient and I have to get rid of it and deal with it. So it's complex developmentally.
We can all talk to Alan at the break. We really, really are. We're actually late on our next session. So we're going to take a 5-minute break, and anybody who wants to ask Dr. Kaplan, thank you very much. Okay.